I have no problem to have the U.S. set up its own quota, truly based on, you know, science and sustainability and the cultural traditions of subsistence.
The Alaska Congressional Delegation pushes for a U.S.-based subsistence whaling quota. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Lance Mackey vents some frustration at the Takotna checkpoint.
At this point, I'm going to have to say doesn't look promising. You know, just I'm going to keep an open mind.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
The U.S. Senate rejected two budgets today that would keep the federal government running through September. One would have cut $57 billion from current spending. That failed 44 to 56, with all Democrats against it, claiming the cuts go too deep and are driven by ideology. Three Tea Party Republicans also voted against it, saying it didn't go far enough. The plan originated in the House, where Republicans included major cuts to Planned Parenthood and defunded the health care law and enforcement of environmental regulations. Senator Lisa Murkowski voted for it. Democratic Senator Mark Begich voted against the GOP-led bill. The Senate also rejected a Democratic-led budget with smaller cuts totaling about $6 billion. Congress has just 9 days until March 18th to come up with a compromise, or the government will shut down. Alaska's congressional delegation are saying they hope to introduce subsistence whaling legislation in the coming weeks. The move comes in response to a resolution passed by the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission last month calling for domestic policy. KBRW's Jake Neer has more.
Subsistence whalers in northern Alaska are beginning the hard work of getting ready for the spring whaling season, but on top of all the traditional preparations needed for a successful year of hunting, whalers this year also have to worry about politics. Specifically, officials with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, or AEWC, say they're concerned their harvest quotas won't be renewed when they expire in 2012. They say the body that assigns those quotas, the International Whaling Commission, or IWC, is dysfunctional and uses decisions over their quotas for political positioning in unrelated matters. Eugene Brower is the president of the Barrow Whaling Captains Association.
But currently, we're under the International Whaling Agreement, where IWC has been giving the Alaskan whaling communities a quota on a five-year annual basis. And every time we try to go for our quota allocation, we have met a lot of opposition, and we're the pawn on the international arena for different countries to get what they want.
The AEWC recently passed a resolution during their annual mini-convention in Barrow, urging Alaska's U.S. senators and representative to introduce a bill that would allow them to hunt under domestic legislation. Senator Mark Begich says they're on it.
I have no problem to have the U.S. set up its own quota, truly based on, you know, science and sustainability and the cultural traditions of subsistence. But I think it's very important that, you know, if IWC can't get its act together, then we have to do what's necessary to ensure the critical lifestyle of Alaskans is protected here through legislation.
But with the new look of this legislature, Begich says the delegation will have some work to do to get their colleagues on board.
So we have a task first to explain to them why whaling is important in Alaska and its subsistence lifestyle that it's part of. It's a process of education. It's something that you just can't do overnight.
The AEWC resolution states legislation needs to be passed before the 2012 meeting of the IWC. Begich says that's a good target.
It doesn't always move very fast around this place, so we have to find our moments of opportunity and then strike as quickly as possible. So hopefully In the next 3 or 4 weeks, we'll have legislation ready to go. We can introduce it. Then it basically, we have it in the mill, you might say, and then we wait for the moment to attach it to a bill or see if it can stand on its own through another means.
He says he hopes to work with AEWC officials in the process of drafting the bill and will make sure they're able to review the language of the legislation before it's introduced. Barrel Whaling Captains Association President Eugene Brower says that kind of local involvement is essential.
Well, under the domestic whaling legislation, you'd have to be looking at, okay, are we going to be using the domestic and the federal code requirements? Oh, if that does happen, and also the agreement that's between the NOAA and the AWC, how's that going to be impacted to manage the whale hunt? So I've got some questions when they start drafting that legislation for domestic management. Isn't it a simple thing? There's a lot of things that have to be covered.
Senator Begich says he's parceling out the workload of drafting the bill with the staffs of Senator Murkowski and Congressman Young. He says they hope to introduce the bill in the coming weeks. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
Martin Boozer is enjoying his 24-hour layover in the Iditarod checkpoint town of Takotna on the Kuskokwim River. The Big Lake Musher arrived last night a little after 10 o'clock with 15 dogs.
I feel good. I think we're going to keep on doing well. I got the dogs right where I wanted them and happy with them. And I left one in McGrath, so I got 15 here and we'll see whether I go with 15. I might leave one of my old guys here. Take only 14 out of here, but we'll see.
The tiny town is crowded this evening with 34 mushers camped out there. Lance Mackey arrived an hour and 45 minutes behind Boozer. Sebastian Schnula, Hugh Neff, Ray Reddington Jr., and Mitch Seavey followed close behind. A handful of mushers have pushed past Takotna and onto the Ophir checkpoint, including Robert Nelson, Trent Herbst, and Sim Smith. They are currently at the top of the standings, but Boozer should quickly regain the lead once he pulls out of Takotna tonight. Many mushers have struggled with dog illness and injury this year, but not Boozer.
Well, a hard, fast trail, of course, makes for some injuries, but my guys are somewhat used to going that pace, so they're doing pretty good.
Boozer is chasing his fifth Iditarod win. Lance Mackey was also hoping to earn that distinction this year, but the defending champion says it doesn't look promising. Tending his dogs in Takotna this afternoon, Mackey sounded frustrated.
I pulled in here thinking I'd stay 6 hours or so and then head out, but I got one dog, I've only got 12 at the moment, and I got one that's not looking so good, so it is about the dogs, and I got to think about them and not what I want.
Mackey is famous for pulling surprise moves out on the trail to secure big leads, but of the four dogs he's dropped already, three were seasoned veterans, and he says that means he'll have to hold back a bit.
You know, I've already lost Maple, my Golden Harness winner. I lost Lippy. I lost Pimp. These are three dogs that were in my team last year that I know what are capable of doing. So now I got a bunch of youngsters that don't know exactly what to do from here on out, and to demoralize their attitude or jeopardize the future. I'm going to have to play kind of conservative and go with the flow. Yeah, if they're up for the task along the way somewhere, we might do something abnormal. But at this point, I'm going to have to stick to normal, I think.
Mackey can't point to any one thing that's affecting his team. He says kennel cough has been a problem. He also says the trail is nice because it's covered in snow, but he says it's inconsistent, hard and fast in places, and then soft and sugary in others. He says that's been tough on the dogs.
Dogs are very bright. It doesn't take them very long to realize that they're going to get sore or hurt or whatever, and they start backing off or not performing well. They're getting out of the way of some of these things. And, you know, so now we got sore backs, we got sore hips, we got bad attitudes, and bad attitudes, no eating, no performance. So.
Jerry Willemitzer became the sixth musher to scratch this year. He made the decision at the McGrath checkpoint today after assessing his dog team overnight. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, paying tribute to an Iditarod superfan.
He wrote Iditarod diaries for the Iditarod for, oh my gosh, when did he start? Something like that, and no one's picked it up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Indian Trust Land IIM account Indian Trust account 3.4 billion dollar settlement website amun indiantrust.com amun biu mountain hwal tuklog lugu 1-800-961-6109.
The seafood company Unisea has agreed to pay nearly $2 million in state and federal fines because of ammonia discharges at its Unalaska processing plant. An investigation by the Environmental Protection Agency and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation determined that Unisea had discharged ammonia, crab waste, and other pollutants into the harbor without a permit from 2005 to 2007. The company also failed to alert the EPA of two significant ammonia discharges in a timely fashion. In addition to agreeing to pay the $1.9 million in penalties, Unisea has been required to submit a comprehensive environmental compliance plan and has agreed to pay the costs of any cleanup. The company has spent $1.6 million on upgrades to its refrigeration system, according to Human Resources Director Chris Plazan.
In every single production facility, there is a small discharge of ammonia, but we've just spent extra money and time to make sure that ours are state-of-the-art.
Unisea's maintenance engineer director, Arthur Ailment, also has pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of failing to report the release of a hazardous substance in a timely manner. According to court records, Ailment waited 1 month before alerting his supervisors of the ammonia discharge. He was sentenced to 45 days in jail with time suspended. Unisea is not the only area processor to have faced environmental penalties recently. Last year, Westward Seafoods was also fined $600,000 for failing to report excess ammonia stores at its Unalaska processing plant and for violating other provisions of the Clean Air Act and Community Right to Know Act. Kevin Fields is chief of the criminal division at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage, and he says that preventing these situations is a priority for his division.
It's important, one, that these provisions are enforced, and that it sends not only a penalty but also a message of deterrence. In terms of making sure that others understand the importance of compliance.
The state of Alaska joined the federal government in its complaint and will not be pursuing separate action against Unisea. New king salmon bycatch regulations went into effect this year for the pollock fishing industry operating in the Gulf of Alaska. Now the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is deciding what to do about chum salmon that are wasted in the fishery. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
It was 2005 when the pollock fleet in the Bering Sea scooped up over 700,000 young chum salmon.
I think everybody in the council recognizes that's far too many fish to be caught in the fishery.
That's Duncan Fields, who is one of 11 voting members on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, a federal body responsible for setting fish policy in those waters. Fields was speaking before a federal subsistence advisory council comprised mainly of subsistence hunters and fishers from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. That body had been pushing for years for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to tackle the issue of salmon bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska. Many blame the pollock fleet for dwindling returns of salmon in western Alaska rivers like the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. The Chinook or King proposals went into effect at the beginning of this year.
I would expect that the council will look at the chum salmon bycatch issue in a way similar to what we did with Chinook.
Those Chinook limits call on an industry cap of 60,000 salmon, but it also allows for a voluntary cap of about 47,000. Field says for many subsistence fishers, that cap might seem high. But he says when you get into the details of the limits, you see some strong incentives to not catch salmon in the high seas.
Every skipper has a specific amount of Chinook, which is very limiting on those fleets. And we've seen fleet behavior change remarkably in the last 3 years.
The 3 years Fields mentioned include the years that it took for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to finally take action on the Chinook bycatch. But the process was scrutinized by the media and the industry, and many knew that stricter limits would be coming down the pipe.
Just the pressure of having those caps in place has created the incentives for the fleet to develop these intercooperative agreements and, in fact, police themselves down to much lower levels of Chinook bycatch.
Fields wants to see a similar system in place to regulate chum bycatch, and that's one of the options on the table. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council is reviewing several options. Proposed caps on the amount of chum taken by pollock fleet include annual caps as low as 50,000 or as high as 353,000 chum salmon. They're also looking at rolling closures of areas that have historically high amounts of bycatch. The YK Delta RAC had been inviting representatives from the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to attend a meeting and begin a face-to-face dialogue for years. Fields is the first to do so when they met in Mountain Village. His visit was part of an initiative by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to increase their outreach in rural Alaska as they prepare to make changes to federal policy. They say they plan on sending members to other regional subsistence advisory boards in places like Galena and Naknek this spring. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council will make a final decision on chum bycatch limits at their Anchorage meeting sometime between October and December of this year. That decision will be forwarded to the U.S. Secretary of Commerce for approval. For KYUK, I'm Shane Iverson.
Researchers in Kodiak routinely survey the archipelago's marine mammal population. Migrations of whales and populations of harbor seals help biologists track the health of the ecosystems, which are indicators for things like climate change and other phenomena. KMXT's Jacob Resnick rode along on a recent aerial survey and has this report.
Check where we are.
We strap into a de Havilland float plane at Trident Basin off Near Island. Researcher Kate Wynn, a marine mammal specialist for Alaska Sea Grant's Marine Advisory Program, sketches out the afternoon's course.
Today, this one here, once we get here, we make a beeline down to Geetic Island. And then we'll do a survey of harbor seals all the way around the island.
Pilot Dean Andrew pushes the throttle forward.
Okay, guys, here we go.
In seconds, we're aloft. It's a clear and sunny day with excellent visibility as we move south, running along Chiniak Bay. At Kaluta Bay, we cut across toward Old Harbor and south to the Trinity Islands. Cruising at about 1,000 feet above the water, I've been tasked to keep a lookout on the right side.
Wait, what am I looking for?
Little puffs of vapor. Sometimes they're breaching whales, they're pretty handy. And if you look straight down when you get towards Ugak Bay, sometimes you can see a big cloud, brownish cloud in the water, which is a mud trail from feeding gray whales. You may never see the whale, so tell us if you see those too.
Wynn says that February is a slow time for whale sightings, but it's important to see how many are wintering around Kodiak before they migrate out of the area.
This would be sort of right between the migrations. The southbound migrators probably finish migrating in early January, and then the northbound guys will start coming back up end of March. And we're able to photo ID them, which we've been working on, and matching our photos with other folks so they don't stay here permanently, but they have been some of, I think we matched maybe 16 by now, with some that have been seen off San Juan Islands and off BC.
It's in the Sitkalitik Straits where we sight our first whale.
You see his long fluke, the front flippers hanging down, they're really long. Yeah, that's a pretty small guy. They're just a little over 1,000 feet, but you can see his white flippers.
What species is that?
Humpback. They're the only ones with those really long flippers. And he's just lollygagging, man. He's hardly moving. Yay, we're not skunked.
This lone male humpback is the only sighting that day, but that's not all researchers are looking for today. The archipelago is critical habitat for harbor seals and other marine mammals. Many of these species have been in decline for years. We buzz along the shoreline of Tagetik Island. This area is indicative of the plight of harbor seals in the Gulf of Alaska.
In the early 1960s, there used to be 20,000 harbor seals on this island.
About how many do we have now?
About 2,000.
Any idea why that is?
Not exactly. That's part of the big mystery. Sort of about the same time that stellar sea lions declined, the harbor seals were declining too in the 70s and 80s. And there was a seal harvest here on this island that was pretty well sustained for a number of years until the early 70s, late 60s. But in the 70s and 80s, the population just kind of tanked. And we still don't know what the reason was for the sea lion and seal decline.
More than 3 hours in the air, we've only seen a single whale, but it's time to head back.
Yeah, this is really our slowest time of year for whales, no doubt about it. Head home, see if we run over one on the way back.
Okay.
Despite the lack of whale sightings, the seal data will be useful to state biologists, and the research is continuing. Around Kodiak Island, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Amendments proposed to a Fairbanks Borough air pollution law would increase fines for burning prohibited fuels in high-impact areas. The changes would increase the fine for burning wet wood, trash, tires, and other banned fuels from the current $30 to $60 or $100 if the offense occurs during an air quality alert. The amendments are being put forward by three assembly members, including Diane Hutchinson. Hutchinson says the higher penalties would only apply in areas around schools, daycare, assisted living, and healthcare facilities.
We would increase the fines in these areas so that it made people think that it really was worthwhile not to be burning the wet wood, worthwhile not to be burning garbage.
A borough ordinance passed earlier this winter already includes a list of banned fuels, but this version would also prohibit burning coal in stoves not designed for it. Hutchinson says the changes are aimed at cutting down on fine particulate pollution in areas where smoke has the biggest health impacts.
We all know that Wood River Schools had a problem. I'm hearing now that Nordale School may have a problem, and you know, there's areas around medical facilities. People have come in with breathing problems, assisted living and daycare facilities.
The borough has focused on fuel since voters passed a ballot proposition last fall that stopped the borough government from banning, prohibiting, or fining residents for using home heating devices. The bill that examines the power of the Alaska Energy Authority to study and construct energy projects along the Alaska Rail Belt finally moved out of the House Energy Committee late Tuesday. The legislation doesn't mention the proposed Susitna Dam, but it would help move the controversial project forward. From member station KTNA, Sue Dio has more.
The bill essentially gives the Alaska Energy Authority powers that it had prior to 1993 to study and build projects, such as the Bradley Lake Dam. It authorizes AEA to move forward on pursuing projects that would provide the rail belt with energy. Even though the governor has thanked the committee for its work, saying the Susitna Hydro Project will provide cost-effective, reliable, long-term power for the rail belt, AEA's executive director, Sarah Fisher-Goad, stated the process had yet to begin.
Once this legislation passes, we would then be in a position to file a preliminary permit application and then start the process that will include significant public meetings with respect to pursuing a licensure of a Wautana project.
The Senate bill counterpart to HB 103, Senate Bill 42, is still in the Resource Committee. It is currently not on the schedule. HB 103 now goes to the Finance Committee. It is unknown at this point when it will be scheduled for another hearing. Some speculate that at this late date, the bill may become part of an endgame bill as lawmakers come down to the last 5 weeks of the session. In Tolkitna, I'm Sue Dio.
Each year in the Iditarod sled dog race, an honorary musher is the first to leave the ceremonial start line in Anchorage wearing bib number one. This year, it was Florence Bush, widow of the late Tom Bush. Tom Bush died unexpectedly last November, but he left a legacy in the Iditarod race as well as at Nome radio station KNOM. Deanna Hecker has the story.
Tom Bush was the general manager and then the development director of the Nome radio station KNOM. His wife, Florence Bush, wore the honorary bib number one as she rode the sled of junior Iditarod winner Jeremiah Klyka of Bethel down 4th Avenue. Florence Bush.
Bib number one is for the honorary musher. It represents Tom and KNOM. I'm also wearing it representing all of the work that Tom did.
KNOM was licensed to the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska, and it has a religious mission. Tom Bush was there to dig through the permafrost to put in KNOM's first transmitter tower in 1970. He then helped establish the radio station and saw to its growth. Under Bush's leadership, KNOM also began a tradition to cover the Iditarod sled dog race blow by blow, keeping virtually every radio in Nome and the surrounding villages tuned to KNOM at Iditarod time. Florence Bush again.
KNOM has been covering Iditarod since the very start. KNOM has always been there for all the finishers.
Tom Bush also left behind a written account of each Iditarod sled dog race for the past 25 years.
He wrote Iditarod diaries for, oh my gosh, when did he start? Something like that. And no one's picked it up. And Team and Trail would publish them every year.
Under the Burled Arch in Nome, Tom Bush has reported on finishes, race results, race strategies. He has written history and he's been an important part in promoting the race. He has also served on the Iditarod Trail Committee Board of Directors. KNOM General Manager Rick Schmidt said Tom Bush will be greatly missed this year and in the years to come.
And being that institutional knowledge, again, this will be our first year without having that. One of our real pleasures, even with him and Florence moving to Anchorage, was making the phone call, well, about 72, 84 hours ahead of time and getting a prediction of when he figured they'd come across the finish line, and he was always very close.
Tom Bush died unexpectedly in his sleep at age 63 on November 1st, 2010. Reporting from Anchorage, this is Diana Hecker.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jake Neer in Barrow, Ellen Lockyer in Tocotna, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, and Deanna Hecker in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Indian Trust IIM Indian Trust $3.4 billion settlement. Website amun indiantrust.com amun BU Mountain hwal tuklulugu 1-800-961-6109.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.